Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So far in this retreat, I've given some discourses trying to help along the practice. By the word practice, we mean what we do rather than what we think. And too often that we're thinking much more than actually practicing, which is one of the reasons why I like to focus the talks on the early part of the retreat, not on theories about what the Dhamma is, what enlightenment is, what the truth is. Because I know from experience that all those thoughts, all those ideas, which might seem so profound, reasonable and true, can so easily, or actually not so easily, but usually are destroyed with the arising of insight. And so often that you realize after gaining the powerful true insights that how much of your time has been wasting trying to figure out the truth, figure out the Dhamma, and through the power of thinking, that one realizes how much one wasted one's time. And so as a result of that, the whole purpose of the way I teach is not so much to teach you what's at the other end of the path, but to teach you how to get to that end. And to encourage especially the practice of samadhi. And that practice of samadhi is the main focus, the main reason that we're here on a 3-month retreat. It's the reason why we have the monastery built in this way, why we have the schedule during the wasa in this way. It's all giving as much support as possible to the achievement of states of samadhi. And I say the achievements of these states of samadhi because it's not just for the sake of the experience itself, but when one travels on that path to samadhi, that one encounters so many obstacles, and each obstacle is an example of one's craving, one's upadana, one's clinging. And otherwise it would not be an obstacle. And so as one pursues this path of meditation, one is uncovering not what one thinks of craving and upadana, but what actually is craving, what is the clinging. One comes across this. And usually that one will struggle and to eventually overcome those obstacles, but eventually that struggle not only lays bare the fact that craving and clinging, upadana, are just so deeply embedded in the mind, and for most people are actually invisible until you get to that part of the practice. It's like sort of digging a deep well and you come across these rocks, which you have to somehow dig around or blow up or drill through or whatever, but you have to go past those things. And these are rocks which you don't usually see on the surface. You only come across them when you start digging into the mind, going deep inside. And these are those cravings and those clingings which stop one from pursuing the path of release. And so coming across these things gives rise to the possibility of wisdom. Without digging that deep, real wisdom, real panya will never arise in you. It will just be superficial thinking wisdom. So every time you come across an obstacle in the meditation, never sort of get depressed, never get fed up, never think you're getting nowhere. You're digging a hole, which is going to be your escape tunnel. And you're bound to come across these things. These are the reasons why you've been put in jail, while you are in a prison of samsara. And so one needs to come across these things. When they come up, we should be, in a sense, expecting them. And when they come up, you should use the opportunity for investigation, for finding out what these things really are. And there's many tools which you can use to break up those rocks in your escape tunnel into samadhi. And they're all wisdom tools. The power of wisdom is far greater than the power of will. And I've used this a lot in my own practice. I've tried willpower, and I found it's never as effective as wisdom power. Whenever you come across an obstacle in your meditation, you can try, you can force, you can just sit there and clench your teeth. But so often, it's because I haven't seen something. There's some way that I'm looking at this meditation, looking at this moment, which isn't according to Dhamma, but which is according to craving and clinging. And as soon as I see that, as soon as I see what I'm craving, what I'm clinging to, what I'm trying to do, when I see the self in it, then you can very easily just turn the mind in another direction. And straight away you just go straight past that obstacle, you go deeper into samadhi. So often you find that the root cause is this I am, which causes one to do things. As soon as there's an I am, a me in there, a sense of self, it will always be trying to control, to do, to make, to be. And it will never allow things to disappear. The way of meditation is the way of letting go, the way of things fading away, the way of things ceasing and disappearing. And that's the greatest challenge to one's sense of selfhood. And that's why the path of meditation uncovers just how hard and deep and profound is this sense of self. But little by little one chips away at it. First of all at the outer casing, then the middle casing, then the most inner casing, until it all disappears. Just like the shells of a Russian doll. You go deeper and deeper in, and you find it comes to the final shell. You open that up, and there's nothing inside. There's not a being, a person in there. But we have to go through these shells of the self. And as we go through each shell of the self, it always has a different factor of doing and controlling. You see that as one meditates. What I was saying last week about patience. What patience achieves is going against that doer, which when it sees a problem always wants to solve it, wants to figure it out, wants to conquer it. And the patience goes in the opposite direction. So just leave it alone. Don't do anything. Just understand the wisdom of anicca, impermanence. These things arise, they'll go by themselves. As long as you are not supporting them through interest or through value, all of those things which arise in the mind, they just disappear. And that should be, you know, one's first wisdom faculty when one even sits down to meditate. I've noticed this whenever I sit down, perhaps it's because I'm getting old now, there's always an ache or a pain somewhere. And when you first sit down, the body wants to move. I can never find comfort when I first start sitting in meditation. But you know that so well, so you're just patient until the body settles. Well, that discomfort, it rose by itself, it goes by itself. The point is, you don't disturb it, you don't do things. You don't look upon that discomfort as something important, as yours. It's not me, not mine. It comes and goes. It's suffering. What do I expect? I'm not going to add to it. Through that just little degree of wisdom, the body settles down. It's marvelous once the body starts to settle down and one gets a degree of the bodily tranquility. The bodily tranquility actually shows you the fruits of overcoming the clinging to the body. The taking up of the body is a problem which you have to deal with. When you refuse to deal with the body, You just place it down, leave it alone, and patiently allow its aches and pains and grumbles and complaints to disappear. When you leave it alone, it just settles down by itself. I've used the symbol before of like a baby throwing a tantrum. And if you actually pay attention to that baby's tantrum, it will throw another tantrum. Because it's got your attention. That's what the whole purpose of a baby's misbehaviour is, to get the parent's attention. But if you completely ignore the baby, then it just settles down. Same way that through ignoring this body of ours, it eventually settles down. And it gives you a sense of direction for the meditation. It's the same with the mind. When it goes thinking all over the place, just leave it alone. Don't value the thoughts. They're not mine. They're not important. All of these thoughts which we have, we're just talking at tea time, all come from the point I am. Because I am, I want to justify my existence by doing something. If I can't actually make, build, create, at least I will think. It's just justifying your existence, that's all, by thinking. Try not thinking. You disappear in that silence, at least a lot of you disappears. And really, that person who thinks, so where has it ever gotten you? So, well, I think most of us, I imagine most of us know by now that thinking causes us lots of problems, because we've been stuck in our huts, we've got nothing to do, nowhere to go, and if you're still stuck in thinking, you're having a rotten time in this monastery. But if you manage to get some silence and peace, this is the most wonderful place in the world. It's really the fact whether you enjoy this monastery or you have trouble here, nothing to do with the monastery. Very much it's depending upon the degree of silence you have in the mind, degree of stillness. And again, just like the body, just leave that thought alone. It's like the mind playing a tantrum, wanting your attention, throwing up all of these thoughts with the label, this is interesting, listen to me, watch me, see where I lead. Just know the tricks of thinking. Just notice how they can con you into following them. They just come up, just don't listen. Not mine, nothing to do with me. It's not valuable. And just be patient, allow all the thoughts to go, to vanish, and to get that degree of tranquility of the mind. Where maybe a thought might be coming up every now and again, but it doesn't sort of catch hold of the mind and carry it anywhere. Just the mind is basically free from the power of those thoughts. And you're finding out that why this meditation works. It's not through willpower that you stop thoughts. It's not willpower that you hold the body still. It's through this wisdom power. It's using wisdom to let go of the obstacles which stop you meditating. And it's strange, you can be thinking all day. You can be worrying all night. And all it takes is just one little bit of insight, just a little bit of wisdom, and all that thinking just stops. I remember just once in my early years as a monk, just we used to stay up all night meditating on the moon nights. And I remember this one night I was just walking meditation backwards and forwards, and it just, I was bothered by thinking, couldn't really be still, and I just noticed that all the thoughts I had, I could recognize them. There were thoughts from what I heard from Ajahn Chah. There were thoughts from what I'd heard from my father or my mother. There were thoughts from what I heard from my teachers. And as I looked at them, I couldn't see one which was original to me. Basically, what I saw, they're all absolutely conditioned. I was just like being a parrot. The thoughts were meaningless. They had no value. They're completely regurgitated, old food. And so when I saw it was old food, regurgitated food in my mind, I spat it out. it had no value anymore. I remember having a very peaceful night as a result of that. Seeing the conditioned nature of all thinking, seeing it did not come from me, it came from Ajahn Chah, it came from my father, my mother, my teachers, my friends, all the people who had influence on me. And you see this again and again. I remember going to, because I was in Thailand for a long time and then I came over here, the first time I went to Amawati, or actually to Chithurst, you know, to visit the monastery there, I saw that all of the young monks were talking just like Ajahn Sumedho. And they're probably thinking like him as well. It wasn't their thoughts or their words, it was Ajahn Sumedho's. And I'm sure if a monk from England comes over here, they'll probably think that all you guys, you know, talk like Ajahn Brahm and think like him. But all those thoughts you have, they don't really belong to you, they belong to me. So throw them away or give them back. And it's true, if they don't belong to me, they belong to what you've read in the suttas, or what you heard in tapes, or what you've heard from some other person. See their conditioned nature, see their cause. They're not ultimate, they're not real, they're not true, they're not valuable, certainly they're not yours. When you see that none of these thoughts are mine, you see where they come from, then it just takes all the interest out of these stupid thoughts. Are using wisdom to undercut, you know, the fuel supply for all this thinking. And that fuel supply, what keeps it going? The craving part of thinking. And it's always because this is important, this is valuable, this is nice, this is going to get me somewhere. So please reflect in that way. And just thinking just stops. It's so nice not to be bothered by thoughts. Thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future, thoughts of where I'm going, thoughts of where I'm coming from. All this coming and going. I've been alive almost 50 years. I haven't gone anywhere. Just wherever you are, wherever you go, there you are again. Coming, going. All this mind is always there. And so that all this moving around, just you get really tired of all of that. All this thinking of where to go, it's just a complete waste of time. Just as when people ask me, where am I going after the rains, or where am I going to go for my sabbatical, or you know, are you going to go to Thailand next year? And the standard answer is like, today I'm going nowhere. Tomorrow, who knows? But basically, just giving up all of those plans. And just emptying the mind. Just last week at Nolamara, the dean's talk, he made one funny remark, which really made me laugh, because he remembered a time in his youth when he was studying, I think at Oxford, when he saw this advertisement for a conference of hermits. And he thought just how weird that would be to have like a conference of hermits, because hermits are supposed to be staying by themselves, not supposed to be having conferences. What type of hermits are they? But the idea of a hermit is always very, very delightful to me. You know, the idea of a hermit, which I used to read in books, about this little old man or old lady just staying up in the mountains in a small hut, having nothing to do with the world. Just maybe growing their own vegetables, living so simply, just living in emptiness. And that ideal of a hermit is something which I really develop in my meditation. To be a hermit, you've got to live a long way from the world. It's called viveka, seclusion. But you also have to live a long way from thoughts. Otherwise, you're not a hermit anymore. A person who might live thousands of miles from other people, but can't really control their thoughts, or rather can't let go of their thoughts. And can't have that silence. What type of hermit do they think they really are? Then they're having a conference inside of themselves. That's the conference of the hermits. The inner chatter. So very often that, you know, I rouse up those ideas in my mind. Like the ideal of a hermit. I contemplate that. I imagine that. whether it's the hermits in the Christian tradition, or much better, the hermits which you read about in the Theragata. Now, you remember some of those phrases of those great monks and nuns, living alone in the forest, in the mountains, in the crags, without possessions, not owning the past, not owning the future, having abandoned all, just only feeling the wind in the moment, but not carrying the wind of the past, not looking forward to the wind of the future, just always in the moment, just free, just flying like a bird carrying no baggage. Just beautiful similes of freedom, of emptiness, of solitude, the happiness, the bliss, the freedom, the release of the hermit. And I take that image and put it into my meditation, my mind. And when I get that image there of the hermit, just all thinking stops. Not only just all thinking, but so often that the attention, the mindfulness, I find is sometimes smeared in time. By smeared in time, it's not really in the present moment. It's smeared a bit into the future and smeared a bit into the past. And because it's smeared that way, it's not precise. It's just so easy just to miss the power of mindfulness. And very often in my meditation, I catch myself and just focus a little bit deeper. As if the binoculars or the telescope has slightly gone out of focus and I just twist it a little bit. Just to get it into sharp focus again. This is what actually is like meditating. You know, even when I'm watching the breath, and sometimes even on limiters, sometimes you just have to just go to that focus of time and just get right into the present moment. And that just sharpens the image up. And with that sharpening of the image, there's more beauty, there's more delight to be seen. Because I'm letting go of that tendency of the mind just to stray from the present moment, to stray from the breath. Instead of having that precise awareness, it's like smeared over the breath. It's sort of on the breath, but on a few other things as well. And actually knowing that is the way to actually to really be a hermit. Not to live like 6 days in your hut, but then on one day go into town. But actually to be a full hermit. To live alone. Alone in the moment, and not going even for a seventh of the time into the past or the future, not smearing or besmirching the purity of one's solitude. And so when I get that physical image up, it really helps direct the mind into the solitude inside, into that beautiful hut in the mountains in the middle of my mind, which is there at any time, which is welcoming to me to go in and be completely free from the world. We just chanted the Dhammacakka Sutta. This world is suffering, it's dukkha. No matter what you try and make of this world. And people have tried for years and years to try and make something happy and beautiful in this world. And sometimes, out of conceit, we think that we know better than anyone else. They may have made mistakes, but not me. I can make something of this world. The Buddha was saying that this world is suffering, it's its very nature. What do you expect? The whole purpose is actually to leave this world. The whole purpose is escapism, to escape from suffering, to escape from samsara. And so that hut in the middle of one's mind, the hermitage inside, that's there for you, but we neglect it too often. Now giving the world one last chance. And how many last chances does the world need? And how about giving not the last chance, but the first chance for real solitude, for really being a hermit? So being a hermit, you just let go of the whole world. I remember this story which one of the disciples told me from Chinese Buddhism about these two hermits who lived on a mountain. One lived up on the higher part of a mountain, the other one lived on the middle part of the mountain. They were brothers, they both had these hermitages. They lived so quietly by themselves. They had an attendant with them. And the Emperor of China was looking for some wise minister to take over one of the important parts of government. And he couldn't find anybody who wasn't corrupt, who wasn't in it for their own advantage or for their power, prestige or money. And so he said he wanted someone who was really pure. And so someone suggested the only pure people in the whole of China were these two hermits. And so the emperor went with the army to go and try and talk these hermits into sort of being part of the government. And he went up to the hermit on the top of the mountain first of all and said, "Hermit, sort of for the sake of your country, for the sake of all the people in China, I need someone like you who's incorruptible, who's pure. Please be a minister in my government." And the hermit sort of said, "Excuse me, Emperor, but there's some filth in my ear. I've got to wash it out." He went into the river and washed his ear. And of course the emperor realized what the answer was. Those words were filth to the hermit. So the emperor went down the mountain to try and find the second monk and ask him to be a minister. And he was about to ask the second monk when the top monk's attendant came running down and said, "I've got a message from the top monk to the lower monk. Lower monk, don't drink the water, there's filth in it. It's dirty." And the emperor realized that these were two good monks, and the asking of them to join the world was like filth. Filth in the first monk's ear, and the monk, because he washed it in the water, made the water filthy and dirty. So how much filth do we put in our practice? Because we want to get involved in the world, involved in doing things, in thinking. And that world is anything from a moment ago to a moment from now in the future. That's filth in the sense that it sullies the mind. It stops the purity of the mind. It stops the mind being radiant. Well, I think last year when I was talking about asupa, the meditation on the impurity, don't just stop with the impurity of the body. Start to also to meditate on those impurities of the mind as well. And thinking is one of those impurities of the mind. It's impure, it's filthy, it's disgusting, because it stops or it mars the beauty of the mind. If you haven't achieved powerful, deep, blissful states of meditation yet, please take it on faith that those states exist. And that these thoughts, ideas, past and future, that's what soils, blemishes, cuts off, hinders and obstructs the beauty of the mind. To use a paraphrase from the suttas, just as a young man or young girl, fond of adornments, fond of beauty, if they saw a carcass of an old snake or dog or a person strung around their neck, they'd be disgusted and they would cast it off. In the same way, a person who knows the beauty of the mind, of the free mind, of the hermit mind, if they saw a thought of lust, a thought of ill will, a thought of busyness of the past or the future, or any thought whatsoever, if they saw that around their mind, strung around their beautiful mind, it'd be like a carcass. Old things, as I said earlier, old thoughts coming from the past. If you really knew what it was, you'd throw it off straight away. It's disgusting. So when we have that asupa sanya towards our thinking, asupa sanya to the past and the future, to develop that in the time of your retreats, of being a hermit, then you find that the mind just moves away from all of that, inclines in another direction. And you get that quietness, that peace, that stillness of the mind. The mind which is empty of thoughts, which can just take up something like the breath or loving kindness which can take up something like the bones or skin or hair or whatever of the body, could just take that up so easily and just stay with it, delightfully reflecting on the parts of the body, delightfully just watching the breath come in and go out, delightfully practicing loving kindness. You can do that because the main hindrances, plans, thoughts, all of that stuff are overcome. So be a hermit in the mind. Be away from the world. And we all know what that world is. Worldliness. Now's the time of your life to leave the world. Later on you may go back there, who knows? But now, if you're going to be a monk, if you're going to be an anagogue, if you're going to be a novice, be a good one. Give everything you've got by giving up everything you've got. By giving up all of those things that you do feel like a hermit. And you feel the bliss of being a hermit. The freedom, the happiness. And once that starts to bite into one, the meditation retreat just gets so much fun. There's so much joy to be had from this path. In fact, the more you get into this meditation, the more you realize just how stupid it is to go down into that world, and how that your happiness, your benefit, and the benefit of others lies with you staying up there in that hermitage in the mind, of being free, of being an inspiration, a beacon of freedom to others. So you realize this is the best thing you can do for the whole world. And you give it even more importance and value. And by giving that silence, that emptiness of the mind more importance, you can dwell with the breath, you can dwell with loving kindness so easily. And it's at that point where it has to happen, because it's natural for this to occur. Once you can dwell with something easily, delightfully, the whole process of meditation, of samadhi and insight and release just happens. Natural course. I think it was that the Buddha said in many cases, once it's like pramuja comes up, this delight in what you're doing, from that comes pity, this sense of rapture, which from that comes a real tranquility. The tranquility of the body and the tranquility of the mind. When you're happy where you are, there's no reason to move. That joy and that pity give rise to stillness, which give rise to an even more deep contentment. Just being still causes happiness. Because of that happiness, you're even more content to be still. He's getting this great spring of benefit, of meaning, of stillness, of release, of freedom coming up, not from anything outside of you, but from deep within. And it just builds up like a snowball running downhill. The more you feel that freedom, the more you have that rapture, tranquility, the more that happiness comes up, the more stillness is developed, samadhi happens. The mind stops all its moving. And the mind stops moving, if you're watching the breath goes to a very beautiful breath. The beautiful breath disappears, just leaving you with a nimitta. All happening as natural as a flower just bursting forth. This is just what happens. And if you're just watching a part of the body, it just happens, it just gets very beautiful and lovely. And even the part of the body disappears and turns into this wonderful nimitta. And these are times when the experience of the path starts to give you insight. These are real things, these aren't just thoughts and ideas, speculations, concepts. This is not something you've got from somebody else. This is something which has arisen in your mind. you've actually got a nimitta there, and it's beautiful and it's lovely, and the body's disappeared and you can't hear anything, and you're just there and just enjoying every moment of this, and this is powerful, this is beautiful, this is actually meaningful. I mean, the Buddha said that the mind is radiant. It's only when defilements come onto it that it loses that radiance. That very famous phrase in the Anguttara Nikaya. You're actually there at that point. You can actually see what the Buddha meant. The radiant mind is your experience in that moment. The nimitta, it's radiant, it's blissful, it's beautiful, it's powerful. Why is it? Because there's no defilements on it. You get the idea of why it is that when you put defilements on there, thoughts, ideas, plans, negativity, lust, ill will, it is like putting a carcass of a dead dog around your beautiful mind. Actually, you realize that simile is not just a monk being negative, that is Dharma, that's truth. You wonder, why do you do that? In fact, you incline not to. And the nimittas come up so much more easier. You're inclining to the purity of the mind, the freedom of the mind. And you come into this hermitage inside, which is beautiful. You talk about a heavenly mansion. That heavenly mansion is not found in the Deva realms. The heavenly mansion is found in this beautiful little hermitage on the mountains in your mind. Now the mansion of the nimitta. It's gorgeous. And it's so inviting that it just pulls you in. And you get this marvelous state of real hermit, the cave of the mind. Deep inside the mountain of mind consciousness. And then the simile of like a cave. There's no light penetrates the cave, nor sound. The feeling of heat and cold is even. The senses have gone inside that cave. In a deep cave of the deepest hermitage right inside the mind. But more importantly, because sound can't come in that deep cave of jhanas, all this thinking just cannot come up at all. All the doing and the willing just cannot arise. You are free. Free from that. And it's amazing, that sense of freedom which comes up there. It's a freedom the like of which you'd have never experienced before. And it gives a profound meaning to this practice. It is not just for the sake of the happiness of the jhanas, because that happiness is so powerful, is so rich with insight. It's when you come out and you leave the experience behind, you've got this new way of looking at life. The mind has had the best fun it's ever had, and it will always incline there, and it will know the only way of getting back to that beautiful hermitage is leaving the world, leaving everything. It makes everything of the world you thought was important and valuable worthless. All the things you really fought for and struggled for and strived for in the world, you realize just what a waste of time that was. All my reputation, what people thought of me, the health of my body, all my knowledge, all my intellect, what a waste of time that was. That wasn't leading me to freedom, but that was the chains which bound me to the world. When you actually see those experiences, you realize what stops you being free. You realize what freedom is. I mentioned this in many talks in Perth. And people in the world, they talk about freedom, freedom, freedom. The Bill of Rights to give freedom to people, the free world and the communist world. They haven't got a clue what freedom is. People in prison not having freedom. People in the world having freedom. You never see a person free in the United States or Europe. Actually, you never see a person free. You can only know that freedom in yourself, in jhanas. is when you see people, they're out in the world, they've left the hermitage. So when you can actually know those hermitages of the mind, you realize they're so far away from conferences, they're really into solitude, to oneness, to emptiness, to leaving everything. It empowers you. And when that sort of energy, which comes up after the emergence from a jhana, is just so strong. If you want to talk about happiness, you're happy for days. And it's okay to be happy, you know. There's nothing wrong with being happy. The happiness of the senses, the five senses, is not really happiness. That's the only reason why the Buddha condemned it. What people take to be happiness in the world, the Aryas, enlightened ones, say that's suffering. And going off and having a nice meal, having sex, going off and having a great cup of coffee in Gino's, or whatever else you want to do to be happy, seeing your favourite movie, whatever else, having a great conversation with somebody. What that people say is happiness in the world. If that's the only thing you know, fair enough, but there's lots more on offer in this monastery. There's lots more on offer in your mind. So don't sort of give up that sort of the first rate stuff for the third, fourth, fifth rate stuff, especially the things of thinking. That's way down the list of happy things. So give up. Abandon. Free. Let go. And you get all this beautiful energy, all this beautiful freedom, all this beautiful wisdom and insights. And it's not something which, you know, doesn't last. Just a memory of one of these events will stay with you for years. And will be at your disposal to bring you back to that sense of peacefulness. It's one of the great results of getting deep meditation. It's like a trauma of the mind. You can remember it just so easy. You can just go back to it so easy, again and again and again. When you actually start getting into jhanas, you don't have to go through all this bother of the next meditation, of having to sort of quieten the body down and watch the breath and go to the beautiful breath and just bring up the nimitta straight away. The mind is powerful enough, just get to a nimitta and go back in. Without the power of the mind is like that bliss at your fingertips whenever you want it. It's like having a butler. Just, James, give me some jhana. And just brings it to you straight away. And this is actually what happens when the mind becomes so well trained. So not only does it give you bliss, but it gives you power, it gives you the memory, the data, so you can always go back there. You know where your hermitage is, where your refuge is. Once you know where that refuge is, the hermitage is inside, you know where all the wisdom is, where the, not in the libraries and the books and the thoughts, not even in the CDs which I'm recording now, that's not where the wisdom is. That wisdom is like actually found in the silence, in the renunciation, in the freedom of the mind. It's free from everything, free from all time, no past, no future. To the fact that even the present moment is just gone. Just now, that's all. All perceptions of time have gone. And the mind is just so still, there's no movement there to create thoughts. Where the breath has long been stilled. All the sensations of the body are just no longer there. All you've got left is this beautiful mind. Free from the body. Free from thought. Free from all the business, free from all the letters, free from all the ill health in the body, free from all the problems, just completely free. So once you can experience things like that, then you realize, oh, this monk life, it's got a good point to it. When the Buddha taught the Samanyapala Sutta, this was one of the real great benefits of being a monk, enjoying those jhanas. it's only starting the benefits, but it's, you know, it's a real first big payoff. So when you get a payoff like that, all the other payoffs, you know, they're sort of right behind, and deeper jhanas and the great insights which come from those jhanas. And that's why they're based on that powerful state of mind, that bliss. So if you want to find out what the Four Noble Truths are about what's suffering or what's not suffering, that's an insight which comes up from jhanas. Because there's so much in the world you thought was happiness. With an experience like that, you see that all that you thought was happiness, man, that was suffering. You just could not see it. Because you had nothing to compare it with. In the same way that the fish who's living in water just cannot know what water is. But the frog who can come into the water and out of the water can know what water is, because it knows what dryness is. A person who can actually leave the suffering of the world by getting into jhanas, going to that hermitage, then they can know the suffering of the world. Because they've got something else to compare it with. The suffering of the Rupa Loka, the world of the five senses. And this is world, they just delight in these five senses. You know, building nice buildings and mansions, beautifying the rivers, going and making nice art museums, you know, putting beautiful women on glossy magazines, having movies, having beautiful music, lovely flowers. Just, what are we doing here? Just trying to find pleasure in these five senses. You never can you really do it? And see if there's something else. Just have a go at just letting go of all that world. I got to talk like this because unless I sort of give you the alternative and start sort of cutting away at the attachment, the clinging to the world of the five senses, the body, time, and all of that sort of stuff. Unless I try and cut away the clinging to that, you'll never have the opportunity to open the door of the inner hermitage and go inside. But really, all I want to do is to get you close enough. If you can get into those states where you're watching the breath, and it's just so delightful just to watch the breath, hour after hour, just watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out. And you get delight in that. Just delight in just watching the body parts. Just delight in doing loving kindness meditation, whatever other meditation object you have. You've got the snowball and it's rolling downhill. And as far as I can see, I can't see why it won't eventually roll further downhill, pick up momentum, and just take you despite yourself, despite what you think you can do and you can't do, despite your fear and control, it will just take you right the way through. That's why I sort of tell you what's happening. You'll be just watching the breath and it just going in, going out, it's just so lovely, so lovely. And the breath will disappear all by itself. And instead of saying what's going on, you know this is the path. You're doing something. And the mind remembers, don't be afraid. Don't be excited. Don't interrupt the snowball's path. Just leave it alone. Just enjoy the journey. Just relax and have fun. Don't be afraid. Have faith and confidence that this is going in the right direction. And the beauty will turn into a wonderful nimitta. And instead of trying, what should I do next? Should I expand it? Should I contract it? Should I move it this way and that way? Just leave it completely alone. You have confidence and faith because you've been told what to expect on the journey. You just don't get out of the bus. You don't sort of argue with the bus driver. You don't take control. You just let everything just go along on its natural course. And you just get into a jhana. You just know what all these words are really pointing to. And also you know why there have been hermits in all societies over the centuries. You know the joy of a hermit. You know the power of meditation. And you've got the the raw data there. You've got the stuff to work with. When the Buddha taught the path, he said, first of all, you have to purify virtue, sila parisuddhi. And then you have to purify the mind, citta parisuddhi, which is jhanas. And then from those two comes the purity of wisdom, the panya parisuddhi. This is the path which the Buddha kept talking about. So you can't purify wisdom without samadhi. So put aside that type of wisdom, all that thinking and studying and working out, and just get a decent jhana this retreat. You all have good enough purity of virtue. It's not absolutely purified, but it's good enough. Everyone in this monastery is a good monk, a good novice, a good anagarika, a good visitor. Your virtue is sufficient. Even people on five precepts got jhanas. You're on heaps more than that. But just be smart. Use the wisdom you have, not to figure out the truth, but use the wisdom you have to stop figuring out. Use the wisdom you have to let go of thought, which is the biggest of your obstacles at the moment. And just trust in the silence. Trust in not doing, just sitting there and just watching. Trust in the joy and the happiness of this path. And just, for the hell of it, just bliss out. And get into all of this. It's there for you, it's there for the taking. Ajahn Chah, he always used to say that it's one of his sayings which is rich with meaning. He used to say that he planted this orchard and he said to the monks, all you have to do is just sit under the tree and watch and wait for the fruit to fall. It's already been planted, you don't have to do anything. The trees are already grown, they're big. The fruit's already on them. It's already ripe. All you need to do is sit there and just hold out your hand. And just it'll fall into you. This is actually a beautiful way of explaining just the path. We do too much at the wrong time. All the doing should be just to put you on your meditation cushion. Choosing your object. Getting you to that sort of that state of where you delight in the meditation object. You're then you're in the orchard. Then just sit down and wait. Wait for the fruit to drop. And so hopefully during this meditation retreat, lots and lots of fruit will drop. You know, some beautiful meditation. Have a really good time. It's there for you. If it's not happening, it's your fault. It's something you're doing, or rather, sort of, something you're missing. So use that wisdom faculty to find out why. It's not that you haven't got what it takes, everyone's got what it takes. It's just sometimes we can just miss it, just by a small fraction of a millimeter. So have a look again. Develop that mindfulness. Develop that feeling for letting go. For abandoning, that feeling for not mine. Take away the value for what's unimportant and put all the value in what's really important in your practice. The giving up the solitude. And be a true hermit in this monastery. Even though you come to the meal, even though you talk to your fellows, even though you tidy up the dhanasala, even if you cook a meal for the monks, that you are a hermit. Because you have that hut in your mind where you can go to at any time and really leave the world. So may you all develop those beautiful states of samadhi which the Buddha praised and said would lead to enlightenment. Just finish off one of my favorite suttas, the Pasadika Sutta. Anyone who practices these jhanas again and again and again can only expect four benefits. Four fruits, four benefits. stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or arahat. Those are the only four fruits from developing the jhanas. So, according to the Pasadika Sutta. So please develop those jhanas, and then one of those four fruits will be yours. Any questions? Okay, let's go.